Hello, everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7. This is lecture two when we talk about software, and in the latter half, we start talking about some light. So I just want to quickly mention some things that we discussed last time, just to make sure that everybody understands. A camera is not required for this course. You might find it easier to have one, but you don't have to rush out and buy one, especially since they cost some money. We do have some cameras available, these Panasonic Lumix digital cameras available for rent from the Church Street Lab. You can get these at 53 Church Street. Just go in and you might have to show your ID or give them your ID while you rent it. But these have the capabilities for you to be able to perform all of the assignments throughout the semester. So you can't, unfortunately, rent it for the duration of the semester. I believe the limit is for 24 hours. But you can, you'll be able to very easily complete the assignments, or relatively easily complete the assignments if you don't have a camera, by going to rent one of these. And we actually are starting sections this week, and so we've released not only a schedule of sections here on this slide, but also on the website, so that you can go and verify what time these are. These start today, and the first one is after class, in 53 Church Street, number 104. That'll be led by John Selig, who stepped out for just a moment. These are meant to be more informal than lectures are, and they'll be a little bit smaller, and so it'll be much more discussion-based, much more question and answer sort of thing. So, and they'll be used to go over material that needs to go over again. So maybe if there's something that you didn't quite understand from lecture, because I do talk very fast, especially when I start getting really excited about this stuff, and we'll slow it down a little bit. And they may not last the whole 2 hours, so you don't have to plan for it lasting 2 hours, but that's up to John, and he'll have more details about that during sections. So when we're talking about digital cameras, last week we were talking a lot about the cameras themselves. So we talked a little bit about the history, and we broke down an SLR and showed you some of the internals of it, the mirror, the shutter, a variety of things that makes it physically work, and so how it physically directs the light into the camera and captures the light onto the sensor. But being digital, we can't worry just about the hardware. We're probably going to need to do something with the photos once we have taken them. We can't just, and though I think my mom might be guilty of this, we can't just leave them on the camera for infinity and expect it to do something automatically. We usually have to have some additional software to do something with the photos. And so whether it's complex software like some of the previews up here on screen, or some simpler software that comes with your computer, iPhoto on Macs, for example, or whatever Windows uses these days, I'm not even sure. You have to be able to download the photos onto your computer, and you usually want to be able to manipulate them in some way, whether that is a lot of manipulation using, for example, the archetypal Photoshop that everybody seems to use these days, or whether you want to do some more advanced work with RAW files, which you might use one of the two pieces of software up top, so Phase 1, Capture One, for example, or Apple's Aperture, or even Adobe's Lightroom. Really depends on what you're trying to get out of these pieces of software, and also what you want to do with the photos. And all of this software ranges in price from free that comes with your computer all the way up to ludicrous amounts of money. And so you don't have to jump out and spend any money to purchase this software right away until you realize what it can do for you and until you figure out which one might actually do what you want it to. And in fact, even these applications that are listed up here each serve a relatively different purpose. So Photoshop, everybody knows, as being the application that you will want to use to modify images in some significant way. And in fact, we are going to be spending a lot of time focusing on Photoshop throughout this course when we're talking about software tools. Today is more of an intro to that, but in later software tools lectures, we really dive into Photoshop and we see how we can do some very specific tasks with digital photographs in Photoshop. But once you start taking a lot of photos, and maybe you're taking them not only in JPEG format, but also in your camera's RAW format, you realize that you're going to have to do some additional processing on them. So you might have to purchase some software like Adobe's Lightroom or Apple's Aperture in order to organize and process your photos. There are other pieces of software available as well. For a long time, iView Media Pro was a popular choice among professionals. Now, it seems to have fallen by the wayside a little bit, but it was very good at the time, very good organizational tool to help help you categorize and tag your photos and find them later, especially if you're taking lots and lots and lots of photos. Phase One, Capture One, this software, they have various versions of it, but it is also raw processing software. And so when we're talking about raw photos, we'll talk more about them in detail at a later time. But basically, they are just sort of the raw data that's coming out of your camera rather than being processed into a JPEG file, into that JPEG format that's lossy, as we described before. Raw is not a lossy format, so you preserve a lot of the original quality and a lot of the original data that JPEG just simply cannot store. And so this usually means that you have to work a little bit more after the fact to be able to get all of the quality out of that raw file that you possibly can. And so that's what some of this other software like Phase One, Capture One will actually do for you. And so organizing your photos is really a question of personal preference. Now, some of you may prefer just using folders and files to do this, and this is perfectly fine, but there's a problem with this, and that is that it becomes... I should talk about the pros first. The pro is that it's free, it's easy to use, you can set up your organization however you like, but the problem is that you are then bound by that specific organizational tool. There's really no other way to search for your files. You can't tag them with specific keywords, for example, and be able to search for them later on. And so this is what a couple of software tools try to remedy. So this is a screen capture of iView Media Pro back when I used to use it. And as you can see, it shows you a lot more information about the photos than you would get in just having them be on your folder structure on your computer. And in this case, it not only tells you the name of the file, but it also shows you a preview of it, which in most modern operating systems you could actually show as well. But what you wouldn't normally see is a lot of the information that is provided by the photo as well, such as some of the exposure details, the ISO speed, how it was metered, whether flash was used or not, so on and so forth. And using this software, you could tag the photos with keywords, which you could go back and search for later and find them in a variety of ways. You can see there's a search bar in the upper right-hand corner so that you could type in keywords, look for it, and search. There's a variety of very useful features within the software, but there was a problem with this as well, and that was that it put all of your photos in one long list. If you see, you can see that on the right here, there's six photos that are visible, but there's also a scroll bar, and you can see that it actually will scroll for quite a long distance. And this is just to show that once you start adding more and more photos, it's hard to just sort of visually scan and find specific images within it. So modern organizational tools and raw tools such as Aperture or Lightroom, if you take a lot of photos, you will probably end up using one of these two pieces of software, if not a competitor that exists today. And using one of these, you can actually get a lot more organizational help out of it. So you can arrange it not only by tagging and by providing keywords to it, but you can also give them a folder structure, a file hierarchy that exists within it. So if you can see in this left side over here, there's some small folders and projects, as they call them, that you can use to organize your photos. And so this isn't meant to be an advertisement for software, but just to show you what I think, after working with this stuff for so long, works and what doesn't work. And so it's taken me a long time to come to photo organization that's like this, or something that's relatively simple, but I've broken it down into relatively few categories. So you could break some of these up into further categories or even combine some of them depending on what you are working on in your particular photos. But I found that this seems to work out pretty well for me. So I have, for example, a folder for jobs. So something where I was hired to take some photos for something. All those photos go into jobs. So personal, that's stuff that's more fun. Those are photos that I take for myself, probably in my home or what have you. And so places, that's it's usually meant to be a little bit more local, so something like the Boston area or any of the smaller cities surrounding Cambridge or what have you, any of these places, Burlington, Arlington, and so on and so forth. Something that isn't really a devoted trip or a vacation necessarily, but just something that I might visit on a quasi-regular basis. Then, of course, things and projects, these are not jobs in the sense that I wasn't paid for them, but these are things that I've been working on. So maybe I have a set of photos that I want to manipulate in Photoshop, and I want to have one place to work on them there. That might be the place for that. Then trips is pretty self-explanatory, I think, and work deals with photos that I might take for my day jobs or for E7, for example. So I have a whole bunch of E7 photos in here related mostly to pinhole cameras. So if I were to expand this, you would see a whole bunch of pinhole photos from a variety of semesters. Now, another thing that's useful when you're organizing your photos is to use ratings. So you can usually, in software, rate photos but with a given number of stars. And so sometimes it ranges from 0 to 5 stars, for example. Maybe you're given more or less. And it took me also a long time to figure out how to use this effectively as well, because I realized that I was spending a lot of time just sitting there thinking, well, is this a 4 or a 3? And I would think, you know, I really wish I had 3.5, but then I said, okay, no, this is getting to be a little bit too much. And so my workflow now involves using ratings to try to help me narrow down the photos that I want. So let's say I import hundreds of photos and I need to be able to process them. I need to go through them and select a subset of them that I want to display on Flickr or on my website, so on and so forth, or send to my family, for example. Then what I might do is go through each of them one by one and just rate it individually as 3 stars or fewer. If it's 3 stars, that means I think it's a worthwhile photo. It doesn't have any major technical flaws that detracts from the photo. It's a photo that I think could be interesting. Maybe it needs some work, something like that. Something that I think is interesting and a worthwhile photo, I'll give a rating of 3 and move on. Then from there, I will rate other photos a 1 or a 2 just based on how crappy I think it is, frankly. And by the end, so I've gone through a whole bunch of photos, maybe hundreds of photos, but doing this makes me go through them quickly. And that way, I can just move on and start processing them. So then I only view the photos that are 3 stars, and then I go through them a second time. And so by now, you will hopefully have decreased the number of photos at least in half, probably, hopefully, a lot less. Then when you go through it, it's a lot less painful, and you can spend more time looking at each photo individually and saying, okay, this photo, you know, it's a great photo, but it's slightly out of focus, or it's slightly blurry, and while I could spend some time working on this, it's not definitely not 5-star worthy. So maybe I'll decide to keep it a 3-star. If it has significant, if it has some promise, maybe a 4-star. And just narrow it down and keep narrowing it down until eventually you get to a collection of 4-star photos. And those are the ones that you should spend time with and work on them and correct them. So while you can begin correcting some of these photos in correcting, I mean doing a variety of software tasks such as enhancing the contrast, fixing the color, really anything that you would do in software, I don't recommend that you start touching that stuff until you've narrowed it down a little bit, because then you're going to have a huge task ahead of you if you're taking a lot of photos to try to manipulate if you're trying to manipulate all of them, it's just going to become overwhelming, and you will quickly find that it is not something that you want to spend a lot of time on. And frankly, even with myself, for those of you that have already joined the Flickr group, if you were stalking some of my Flickr photos, you may have noticed that I added a whole bunch of them recently, and that's because I had a backlog. I hate processing photos, but I love taking them. So I end up with thousands of photos that I have to go through, and then it's just such a pain to be able to go through it. And so anything that can be used, even to just help me just the tiniest bit to become faster processing these photos, helps significantly. And one of these ways is using a workflow like that, where you just narrow it down and narrow it down and narrow it down continuously until you get to a small subset of photos that you want to work with. So this leads us to keywords. I used to be really gung-ho about keywords and tagging them, providing specific words to photos that perhaps describe it in some way. And so this got to such a ridiculous point. And I was using iView Media Pro that if a photo had a tree in it, I would put a keyword of tree. If it had a shadow that was potentially interesting, I would label it as shadow. And so Now, when I've moved to Aperture and it's imported all of those keywords, and the first few versions of Aperture, just as a small anecdote, were really kind of slow, and importing all of those keywords just made it absolutely unbearable because there's thousands of keywords, and I've collapsed them all here. You can see there's an iView Media Pro keyword that has a bunch. If I clicked on that arrow and expanded it, we would be waiting several minutes for it to just keep working and show us all of the keywords. And it gets really ridiculous. Now, where I think keywords are useful is if you sell your photos, for example, in stock photography. So in stock photography, what you have to do is try to market your photos based on its content. So if you are taking a photo of, somebody that's doing accounting work, for example. You might have somebody in glasses, you could do the stereotype, have somebody in glasses with a pen protector working on a calculator, for example, and you might then want to keyword each of these specific things because that will help expand your marketing for that particular photo. But if it's just for yourself, I've noticed that you really don't have to tag photos quite so much. You don't have to worry about it so much, and in fact, the only keywords that I use are involved in this hierarchy, in this organization here. So I know that if I want a lot of trees, for example, that maybe I want to go to some main trips where I took photos of a lot of trees. So I'd go into trips and then look through some of the trips there, see if I could find one that was related to that. So I could use context of the photo to try to find some of these keywords. However, it really depends, of course, on what you want to do with this. So maybe you take a lot of pictures of people, of your friends and of your family. You might want to have some keywords just of your friends and family so that you can tag your photos with those names so that you can easily find them later. There is actually some software, though. I don't think Aperture or Lightroom will do it. I think iPhoto, for example, will do this, where it'll try to automatically process each of your photos and find faces within them and then try to figure out whose face it is. So if you label a couple of photos with a name, then it will associate all future photos with that name, and it'll actually show you that person's face. And so I tried it because it sounded kind of cool, but I don't think it works that well yet. I think they have to work on it a little bit. But it definitely is some neat technology, and if that's something that you want versus having a lot of keyword specificity, then you might want to consider using some simpler software. Now, when we're talking about organization and keywords, you have to realize that the photos that you take in your camera actually have a lot of data embedded within it, something that you don't actually see when you're just viewing the picture on your screen or maybe even on your camera. There's a lot of detail about that photo that is recorded within the file, and it's transferred onto your computer with the file. It's actually a part of the file that is not visible. And any good photo organization program will show this data to you, and it can be very useful to you to try to figure out how this photo was taken or what settings you used and how you want to be able to change it in the future. So we can see that for this particular photo, it was taken on a specific date with a specific camera using specific settings, and we can use that to our advantage. And in fact, using this data, this is called EXIF metadata, and this is data that Flickr uses as well. Whenever you look at a Flickr photo, well, I don't have one available, so this could take me a while, but whenever you look at a photo, there's usually a button that says more info. And when you click on that button, it usually tells you all of this same data that was provided to you from the camera. And this helps us. So it not only helps you, but it also helps us, because when we say that you should be using some specific settings on your camera, that you should be within some certain exposure range or something like that, we actually look at this data to make sure that everything is as expected. And so this is really, the Wi-Fi in here is terrible, so I won't be able to show you, but we can see that here this data is available to a wide range of software, and that includes websites that you upload your photos to. Now, this data can actually be manipulated, but don't manipulate it, please, because it's not only destructive to you, but it's also destructive to, not to you necessarily, but it's destructive upstream. Whenever you upload the photos and someone tries to look at it and view the metadata, it's interesting to them usually to be able to show it. So if you don't want them to see how you took this photo for whatever reason, then you may want to remove it. But certainly for this class, whenever you upload photos, you should make sure that this data is intact. And if you don't do anything to the photo when you upload it, then there's nothing to worry about. The data will be intact. But if you open it in Photoshop, for example, even when you resave a file using Photoshop, it will append additional information saying that it was written by Photoshop. And so it's obvious for people to tell when a photo has been manipulated or at least opened and resaved in Photoshop. So when I'm talking about all of these ways of manipulating photos, really, you can listen to me or you don't have to. This is just some advice that I want to impart on you. But this is what works for me. And like I said before, anything that makes it faster to start processing these photos and get them out of your queue and up on the internet or out to your family is a good thing. Whatever you can do to get these out faster and so you can take more photos in the end, that's usually the goal. Or I guess if you want to spend time with your family, but who wants to do that? Okay, so the last piece of advice that I am going to hammer into you, and I really am going to hammer it into you, literally, I have a hammer in my backpack, is that you must back up. It is, if I could make a requirement for this class, I would, because backing up your data is so important. I have so many stories of data that I've backed up. Okay, so here's a good one. So I had a laptop with all that iView Media Pro photos that I mentioned to you, and an external hard drive, like pictured here, that I would plug into the machine and back up every day or every 12 hours or something like that. And I was thinking, okay, I'm set. I have a laptop with all my photos and a backup drive with all my photos. But guess what happened? One day I woke up, I went to turn on my computer, turned it on, the hard drive was dead. And I'm like, okay, it's a little nerve-wracking, but it's not so bad. I have a backup. But it turns out my backup was dead as well. So now, as a result, I did lose some photos. Not a lot. I did lose some photos, but it just was a fluke. And I remember going to the Apple store and because I had an Apple laptop and complaining to them that I needed a new hard drive because it had broken. And they told me, oh, there's no way that both of them could have broken at the same time. It's statistically impossible, but it actually did happen. And so you're playing with fire with hard drives. They're moving parts that are moving very, very quickly, and it's not something that you want to rely on just on having one hard drive. All of your data, all of your important bits of data, including your photos, if those are what are really important to you, you don't want to have them just on one hard drive or even just on two hard drives. I would tell you my backup scenario now, but I would embarrass myself with how many hard drives I have. Okay, it's 4. So back up your photos. It's not that expensive to do. Even 500 gigabytes will store a ton of photos, even your really important personal data, maybe even some emails, so on and so forth. And this is pretty cheap. You can even go to Best Buy or any local store and find some relatively cheap hardware to an external drive to store your photos. And if you're truly paranoid, you're going to do more than just store your photos on several external drives. You will also store them in completely different geographical locations as well. Yes, I do this as well. So the reason is that imagine, you know, God forbid, there's some really apocalyptic event in your home. So it burns down, it floods, something like that. So it doesn't matter how many external drives you have. You're going to lose all of that data. And you can't store your computer in one of those big fire safes because then it will overheat. So you can't do so. You really, the only way to protect yourself is to have many copies of it in as many places as possible. So there's a variety of online backup solutions. Unfortunately, there's not a great one that I can really recommend right now for you to offload your files onto either the internet or even someplace else. Most of the time, using an offsite backup takes work. So that means you have to do something like, and what I did for a little while was I had two external hard drives. I had one plugged into my computer, and then I had one in my car, and I would swap them every so often. And that ended up not working very well because I would never do it, and the hard drive froze or something. So literally, because it was cold outside. So these are things, risks that you take when using the computer. And there's a lot of them in addition to just losing your data, but it's something that you should spend time trying to figure out. Yes? Are the fixed state flash drives more reliable? theoretically they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be more reliable from bumps and shocks and that sort of thing, because the tolerances on these hard drives are very low. If you're not familiar, there's a spinning platter, and literally less than a hair's width away is a piece of metal that hovers over it, reading the data off of it. And if it gets bumped, then usually that piece of metal can gouge into the hard drive, and there goes some of your data. And so the solid-state drives, which do not have movable parts, are supposed to help with that, and they do have better shock resistance, but they still are prone to failures because they will wear out eventually. They'll have electrical surges. That sort of thing can also cause them to fail. They might be more reliable, but I don't have concrete data on that. But still, if you're using one, you should still back up your data. And in fact, it's harder to recover data from a solid-state drive than it is from a hard drive. If you do have a failure, you're worse off. Okay. So using software tools, you can actually do quite a bit more than just organize your photos. You can also interact with a camera. And so even cameras that are 5 years old have the capability, or many of them have the capability, to connect to a laptop computer via a USB cable, and you can control them using software. So using Aperture, or using the software that came with your specific camera, you can usually fire the shutters. You can actually click the shutter from afar using your computer. And so I have to say that this sounds to be of limited use, and it is if you for particularly advanced setups. But if you want something that's easy, so for example, you have a studio setup where you need to take a lot of photos of something or someone, and neither your camera nor the computer is moving, this is a very good situation. It's a very good scenario, because you can take a photo from your computer, it will automatically be downloaded, and you can see it on your computer right away and be able to make adjustments. And I guarantee that no matter how big the screen is on your camera, it's still not very big. And once you see the photo on your computer screen, it's going to look a little bit different than it did on your camera. Generally, worse. It's because usually when you see it on a screen this big, you're like, wow, it looks so awesome. You remember chimping? Ooh, ooh, ooh. So usually when you bring it to a computer screen, which is much larger in comparison, then you can actually see what the photo looks like, and you may be disappointed. And so if you can have a live view of that photo just as it was taken, then you'll be able to make modifications to it be able to retake the photo right away. And in fact, newer cameras even have the capability to display like a video feed of what they see over to the computer, so that you can actually, you don't even have to take a photo, and it will show you exactly how the photo is framed and how it will look with that light. How it will differ is if you have flash, for example, if you have some strobes that fire and then it alters the light in some way. But still, that can be very useful, especially for taking a look at the focus, you know, how well focused it is, if it's on a macro subject or a variety of things. And as much as I wish that this technology was available cheaply, it's not really possible yet to do all of this wirelessly. So, well, that's a bit of a white lie. It is possible to do, but it's just exorbitantly expensive to try to transfer or to be able to control your camera wirelessly for now. So if you were thinking that you would connect your camera to your computer and be able to take shots wirelessly, so that you can do something crazy like attach your camera to the outside of your car and drive really fast and then take photos, you might have to think again, because you will have to string a long USB cable from the computer over to the camera in order to do that. There do exist some piece of hardware, I think it's called iFi or something like that, where they're small SD cards, and most digital SLRs don't actually take SD cards, they take the larger compact flash cards. But if you have a compact digital camera, for example, it most likely takes an SD card. And that has, I believe, some of the iFi SD cards actually have Wi-Fi built into them, and they are, I think, somewhat reasonably priced for what they are, so that you can actually send those photos that you've taken over to your computer remotely or wirelessly once you've taken them. But usually you lose the ability to have that live view that I was talking about before, where you could actually see the screen, or you could actually see what your camera sensor sees on your computer screen while you're manipulating the settings. Okay, so one of the things that we will be talking about, and not really going over much today, but just introducing you to the fact, is that the benefits of RAW files over JPEG are quite numerous. And though there are some disadvantages as well, if you want the highest quality out of a photo, you will generally need to take that photo using the RAW format. And when you take a photo in the RAW format, because it is, as it sounds, sort of the raw data that's come out of the camera, you have a lot more options available to you in terms of manipulation of that photo. And not only do you have these standard controls available to you as part of raw processing, which include exposure, saturation, brightness, and contrast, but they actually, all of these become much higher quality to adjust when you are using the raw format. And really, this is meant to be just a teaser, because when we're going over this stuff in future lectures, where right now we're really taking photos in JPEG mode and we don't have to take any in RAW mode, hopefully a lot of this stuff will become apparent. But using the software tools to process photos in RAW is actually, it's a mixed bag, because though it does provide you with the best quality output, usually it also takes some additional time for you to be able to process all of these photos. But one of the things that we can do now when we're talking about software tools is resizing and cropping. So this is actually something that you can do. Really, it doesn't matter how you take the photo or with which camera or even what software you use, but most of the time software will allow you to resize or crop the image. And this is a good thing, because most of these images that you take are very, very large. If they're 8 megapixels or 10 megapixels or so on and so forth, we're talking about 3,500 pixels wide by about 2,500 pixels down, and that's larger than just about all of your computer screens, unless you have an abnormally large computer screen just sitting at home. And so when you take these photos, if you were to crop them or resize them, you can actually make them a lot more manageable of a size for you to send not only to your friends and family over email, but also to Flickr, for example. And so if you keep, I think I'm a big fan of keeping the original sized photographs at 100% only available to yourself, and sending out slightly resized versions of those, because then it's a lot easier to prove who the original photo belongs to. If you have the original 100% version of that photo, then it's a lot easier for you to make an argument and say, look, I have this photo in its original resolution, I bet you don't. And you could go, you could combat any sort of copyright issues that you might be able to come across. Of course, that's not tested, but it might actually work, I think. And so, but it has the side benefit not only of that, but also, like I said, because we're dealing with monitors that are really quite small in size relative to the size of these images, resizing them down to maybe, let's say, 1,000 pixels wide by however tall it is usually a good way to go, because then that photo will still take up a good sizable portion of that user's desktop, may even take up the entire thing depending on the size of their monitor, but you are making it a lot more reasonable. However, when you are cropping a photo, one of the things that you have to be concerned with is how much resolution you have. And so one of the things that we'll be talking about throughout the semester is that you really don't need to concern yourself too much with megapixels. Just about every camera available on the market today has enough megapixels for pretty much whatever you need it to do. But where this does become useful is when you are cropping something, and specifically when you are cropping something a lot. So as you remember from the first lecture, we were talking about these files as being raster files, and what that means are bitmap files, and what that means is they're made up of pixels, or basically a matrix of of small dots that that have different colors, whose combination in the end makes up the original photo that we see here today. And when you really get down to it and zoom in on one of these photos quite a bit, or if you try to crop it by quite a lot, then part of the problem is that you could start to see some of these individual pixels, and you would get a problem, what we call pixelation. So like what you see here, and I apologize that the contrast is low, I still have to work on the lighting here, but you can see I've zoomed in quite a bit on a particular portion of this image, and you can see the individual blocks on some detail in this image. And well, this it's kind of neat to look at. You don't want to do this all the time. So when you're cropping an image, you don't want to crop too much or risk resizing. And in fact, whenever you see some piece of software or anything on TV or in the movies that say enhance, and then magically you can see all of that detail that used to be there in, you know, in real life but isn't there in the photo, I can't say what I really think about it, but it is terrible. It's not right. You cannot actually create data where there was none. As you can see from this photo, this is as much data as we have from this particular section of the photograph. And your guess is actually probably better than a computer's as to what this thing is or what the details of this thing actually look like if you were to look at it at a much higher resolution. So resizing, if you're going to resize photos, it's generally okay to resize photos down to make them smaller, but you have to be really careful when you're resizing photos up and making them bigger, because you are risking pixelation. And no matter how good of a program you were using to resize these photos, you were going to get some weirdness, so if you'll let me use that term, out of a photo when you try to make it larger. You're not going to get additional detail out of it. You're just going to begin getting pixelation. Or good photos, or rather good pieces of software like Photoshop, will try to use some tricks to try to make it look a little bit sharper, like make it look like it's gotten a little bit more detail. It doesn't work very well, and it will only, it's really only a Band-Aid for, you know, a huge gash in the problem of resizing a photo and making it much larger. So this is especially applicable to compact digital cameras that use digital zooms. So sometimes they have this ridiculous notion. This was very popular, especially a few years ago, where they would say, oh, we have, you know, 120x total zoom or something like that. And when you actually got down to it, you saw that it had, you know, 4x optical zoom and 80x digital zoom or something like that. And all it is doing, the digital zoom, is literally just resizing the photo to be bigger. It's just making it bigger and cropping it so that the end result is that it has the same number of pixels, but you have much less data, because it is as if you're taking, you know, a small portion from the middle of the frame and making it bigger and getting all of that pixelation and losing all of that data that existed before, and you're getting the same size file. It's just a waste for everybody. It's purely a marketing thing. It doesn't help you get any better resolution out of these photos. It doesn't help the camera resolve any additional detail that might have existed in the scene. If you have a camera that has both optical zoom and digital zoom, disable the digital zoom. It's really not doing you any favors, and you can do a higher quality digital zoom if you really want later on your computer. No matter what, the algorithms in your camera just are not as good as the ones that are in good programs such as Photoshop that are available on the computer. So turn off the digital zoom. It's just a waste of your time, and crop later if you really, really want to. So megapixels really aren't that important unless you're doing a lot of cropping. If you're doing a lot of cropping, so for example, people who take photos of birds, for example, usually need to get the longest lenses they possibly can, the biggest lenses they possibly can, and to get the most detail they possibly can to be able to crop these photos. And usually that means you will want to have a slightly higher megapixel camera. This comes at a certain expense, though, and we'll talk about this throughout the semester, but usually having more megapixels is not always a good thing. So be wary of that when you're buying a digital camera. If you're looking at two, and you're leaning towards one because it has slightly higher megapixels, don't worry about it. It really doesn't make that much of a difference. Look at all the other features that come with the camera instead. That is what will make the biggest difference to your photos. So I alluded to Photoshop earlier, and as great of a program it is, it really can't be used to fix everything. Well, I guess really good Photoshop artists might be able to fix everything, but then at that point it's not really a photograph anymore, I would argue, and more a piece of digital art that they are manipulating. And I ran across a website earlier today from Adobe, where they actually were, I guess, annoyed at people for using Photoshop in a verb form, where everybody says, "Oh, that looks so Photoshopped," or a variety of how we've really brought the word Photoshop into the vernacular. Is just a colloquial term for manipulating these photos, and they have, and it's this hilarious webpage. They have examples of what is correct and incorrect use of their name, and so they say, "This is incorrect." It says incorrect : this photo was modified by photo. No, this photo was Photoshopped, and then it says correct. This photo was modified by Adobe registered trademark Photoshop, and it's like, who's going to type that? I mean, I understand that they're trying to protect their trademark, and I'm not trying to make fun of them for that, but I do think that some part of us has to accept that there is a reason why Photoshop has become so popular for doing these things, and it is an expensive program, but it does what it does very, very well once you have learned how to use it. But it does come at a cost, in that there are excellent Photoshop artists out there who do manipulate photos quite a bit. For example, this Time cover was a real cover that ran, that Time magazine ran a few years ago, I think, and it was actually a photo of Reagan, but the tear was fake. They actually Photoshopped that in, they modified the photo with Adobe registration program Photoshop, and added the tear later. And a few people got really upset with this, saying, "Oh, they're misrepresenting the photograph. This is not how the photographer wanted to portray Reagan." It just caused a whole stir. And in fact, though many people think that this is sort of a new thing, modifying photos is actually nothing new at all. We have actually been doing it for almost as long as photographs have existed in the first place. Let's see. I have here something very cool that I think you will all like. So luckily, this is... I'll post a link to this website later, and unfortunately, I don't have very good internet access, so I can't show you the live page right now. But even photos going as far back as around 1860 have been manipulated by artists to alter them in some way, and sometimes in a very, very major and very, very real way. Okay, I'm sorry, this lighting is bothering. Let me just try dimming them, or is that better? Oh, how about that? Okay. So in this first photo, for example, this is probably a photo that many of you might have seen of former U.S. President Abraham Lincoln, but this photo is fake. It is not actually of Abraham Lincoln. It is actually a photo of John Calhoun with Abraham Lincoln's face pasted right on top. And I don't know if this link will work, but showing you the combination of the two. Oh, here we go. We can see both. Oops. We can see both side by side. The real photo is on the right, and the doctored photo, the fake photo, is on the left. So photoshopping is nothing new. We could be using a different verb for it, but luckily Photoshop, or rather Adobe, gets all of the attention for now. But there's a variety of examples of this. So in 1930, for example, Stalin airbrushed out photos where he was standing next to his enemies, for example. And so this photo that's visible here is actually, he actually removed somebody, I'm sorry, I don't know who, he removed somebody from that photo. Well, he didn't, but somebody else did. And they actually did a pretty good job, I think. It's kind of hard to tell. But if you look really closely, you might be able to see a little bit of a bump in the railing here that looks a little soft and a little fake. Pixel peepers, so they're called, people who really look at every single pixel in an image and really analyze it to try to determine if it's real or fake, would do a pretty good job at spotting something like this. But the rest of us would, just looking at a photo, especially if it was just in a history textbook, for example, or in a newspaper, would have a hard time spotting that some of these were fake. And this was, you know, years ago. They've been doing this for a long time. This one's a good one. So this is a heroic portrait of Benito Mussolini, but he had the horse handler removed from the final photograph so that he would look more heroic than the original photo might actually convey. You can see the horse handler over here just holding on to the horse. So there's great examples of this throughout history, and like I said, I'll link to this page because this is a lot of fun to go through and read. And of course, they do reference something such as modern techniques such as airbrushing, where they take photos of models and manipulate them to smoothen their skin or enhance the color, etc. But where I think some of the most offensive ones as a photographer are ones that are presented by photojournalists, so ones that are meant to be photos of what actually occurred, and they have been modified in some way to enhance some aspect of the image. And unfortunately, as much as I respect them and their photographs, National Geographic was even guilty of doing this at one point, where they actually enhanced this photograph of the pyramids in order to fit more of it onto their cover. And so this may seem like picking it at straws, and it might be, but they squeezed the pyramid, they squeezed the aspect ratio a little bit so that the pyramids looked taller than they actually meant to be in real life. And this, I think, was a misrepresentation of how that scene actually appeared in that case. And actually, there's plenty of examples of this happening even in modern times. Let's see if this still exists. Nope, okay. So back, let's see, this was back in July of 2008. The New York Times, I think, in addition to, well, actually worldwide newspapers, actually ran a photo that was given to them by a photojournalist in Iran, and I think the Iranian government had somehow gotten a hold of it. And this was published in numerous major websites, but also newspapers. The New York Times was included, where they showed a variety of missiles being launched. But when they looked at it and they analyzed this image, they actually figured out that they had added an additional missile to the photo. So they had literally copied and pasted one of the missiles, one of the nearby missiles, over onto this one. It looks like there's a missile launcher that's just waiting there, waiting to fire its missile, or maybe there isn't even one on there. But they decided to make it a little bit more dramatic and just add in the other one anyway. And this caused a big stir and was actually a big thing and brought this sort of this ethics problem of whether or not we should be allowed to modify images with Adobe Registered Trademark Photoshop, or whether we should just present them as they are. Yes. Oh, really? Okay.
My question is, do you think that having this awareness of Photoshop now that it's become so mainstream has actually made it more of an ethical question than it used to be in terms of photo manipulation?
It's a good question. Do I think that the ubiquity of Photoshop has really made this more of a question than it used to be? Yeah, I think it certainly is. It does seem like more people are concerned with it than we used to be. Like, I certainly didn't care back when I was in grade school that photo of Abraham Lincoln might have been doctored. I probably wouldn't have cared even had you told me. But now that so many people are aware that images are modified and changed, there really does seem to be this big stigma now, and even in the way I'm presenting it, I'm sure I am perhaps influencing this in some way as well, that modifying a photo is in general a bad thing. And if you're able to capture a photo that looks amazing, like one of these doctored photos, or even this Iranian missile photo, where it had been of the real thing, that would have been great. But as soon as people realize that it's been manipulated in some way, that seems to take away from the skill of the photographer, if that makes sense, and that that person is not as skilled as the people thought that they originally were, because they said they are now thinking, perhaps to themselves, that, oh, this photo is not as how the scene actually was. It is manipulated, and therefore the photographer is not as good as he or she is presenting himself to be. So yeah, I certainly do think that this is something that is becoming more prevalent and more noticeable. But I do think that no matter what the end result is, photojournalists and photojournalism in general should be held to a standard of presenting a photo as it was, because that is what they are claiming to do, so that they should not be then modifying the image, especially one as blatantly as this. It's a very gray area. So once we start talking about stuff like, well, could I really add maybe a little bit more red or a little bit more contrast to this photo to make it pop a little bit more? Is that okay? That's a tougher question to answer, and I think it really depends. And I think even on this page, there is an example of one photograph of a firefighter somewhere. Let's see. Oh, I hope it's here. Oh, yeah, here it is. So this photo was taken by a staff photographer for the Charlotte Observer, and he ended up being fired because he enhanced the photo to have brighter colors or more saturated colors so that it looked more dramatic than it originally was, and he ended up being fired for that. And was that acceptable? Was that a good reaction to that? It's harder to say. I suppose it really depends a lot on context and a variety of things, and I certainly am not one to say whether or not that small of a thing was acceptable or not. There does seem to be sort of this line that can't be crossed, but enhancing the color, I'm not so sure. And certainly for our purposes, in terms of being photographers for ourselves, for our families, or even for clients, we generally are not held by these same standards. We can enhance the color and perhaps are expected to, because if you really want your photos to pop, usually the way they come out of the camera is not good enough. The colors are a bit neutral, and you have to increase the saturation on them or even the contrast a little bit to get them to look really, really bright maybe, or to really stand out among a crowd. And if you don't do that, you're doing your photos this is a bit strong to say, but you're doing your photos a disservice if you're not enhancing them just a little bit, I think, because providing them with that extra pop and sizzle is really what gets a lot of photos noticed. And that is what how a lot of people get their photos known, is by having some really exaggerated feature, something that's really exaggerated in a photo, nowadays at least, that may not have existed before. And so, of course, you can go too far. You don't want to go too much with the contrast or with the saturation, but just adding a little bit, just to give them a little bit something extra, is probably okay for your photos. Okay. But all of this stuff, I mean, this stuff I think is really interesting, and you should take a look at this at this website, because there's a whole bunch of photos that are shown throughout photojournalism history that misrepresent the photos that that they meant, or the scene that they meant to exhibit. So in this one, for example, there's a photo of a fire from Reuters, and they added some additional smoke to make it look more dramatic. But if you look, it doesn't really take much, even if you're not very familiar with Photoshop, it doesn't take much to realize that this is really, really obvious, that it's been obviously copied and pasted. I think my 12-year-old brother could do a better job than this at making the smoke look a little bit more billowy. So this is not cool because, I mean, not only did they manipulate it to make it look more dramatic, but they did a, you know, they did a smackingly bad job of it too. They shouldn't have fired that Charlotte Observer guy. They should have fired this guy. Okay. But anyway, using Photoshop to manipulate images is a tricky subject, as you can tell, and there's a variety of times when it's appropriate to do it and a variety of times when it's not appropriate. For assignments, unless you're told to do it, don't make any modifications, please, and we will know, because like I said, the EXIF data reveals all. But really, when outside of this class, for your own photographs or even for the final project, you'll find that manipulating these photos is a really great way to be able to accomplish a wide variety of tasks on them. And throughout the semester, we will talk about how to do that and how to do some really cool, really neat stuff. So let's take a quick 5-minute break, and when we come back, we will talk all about light. Okay, hello everyone. Welcome back. So if you didn't happen to attend the first lecture for whatever reason, we do have additional printed syllabi and assignment ones in the far back corner if you want to pick those up, but they're also available online if you just want to download the PDF and do that. And of course, just as a quick reminder, we do start the sections tonight with John Selig, who is now in the back there, and he will start those right after class in 53 Church Street. I did say I wanted to start with light, but I wanted to mention two things because I forgot to in my slightly hurried pace earlier. And when we're talking about talking about photos with resizing and cropping, when you resize and crop, you want to keep the aspect ratio the same. And I don't think I clearly defined aspect ratio in the first half. And that is literally just the ratio of the width to the height of the image. So for example, old style TVs, the ones before HD TVs had an aspect ratio of 4:3, so that the width was 4 times, the width was 4 times some number, and then the height was 3 times some number. Usually, images from SLRs have an aspect ratio of 3:2, so they have for every 3 pixels across there, they have 2 pixels of height, so on and so forth. And when you do resize, you want to keep the aspect ratio the same. And usually, software tools will call this a variety of different things, such as scale proportionately or something else, where it will fix changing the height and the width the same amount. And this is generally what you want to do, because if you change the aspect ratio, remember from the National Geographic photo where it squeezed the pyramids, that they looked a little bit taller, they changed the aspect ratio in that. They did a resize while changing the aspect ratio. And if you are absolutely dying to hop into Photoshop, I do actually recommend something online that can get you started, and you can find it on YouTube, and it's called You Suck at Photoshop, and it is absolutely hilarious, especially the first few, and I was hoping that some of it would download over this terrible connection that I have right now, but none of it has, but it's funny and, for the most part, educational. If you're easily offended by foul language, then perhaps it is not the thing for you, but it is something worthwhile to procrastinate at work, for example. So, all right, moving on to light. So, when we're talking about light, we are talking about, you know, the light that we see, and this is the same light that is captured by the camera. Without this light, there's no photos. We have no way of being able to capture a photograph. And light is, I mean, if you remember from way back in your high school physics days or even college physics days, it can be defined as a photon that's moving, and it has properties of both waves and of a particle, variety of other things. But really, you can think of it as this electromagnetic wave that's moving through the atmosphere or through space, for example, that has a specific frequency. And we can only view a very narrow portion of the frequencies that are possible by electromagnetic radiation that is propagating throughout the universe. And so, but because of this sort of duality of properties, where it has both properties of waves and of particles, and you may be kicking yourself for maybe wanting to pay more attention back in your days of high school physics. Don't worry about that too much, but really what's interesting is that because of these two properties, that light behaves as a wave and also simultaneously in some ways as a particle, it impacts us as photographers in very, very real ways. And each one of these properties actually impacts us in a different way. So because of the way that it propagates as a wave, we have to deal with certain things. And because of the way that it's actually a photon, it's a particle that's moving through, or it can act as a particle that's moving through space, that also has a specific impact on us. And so if we're talking about particles, you can think of light as just being... I already described what it is, but because these photons are moving through space, the number of photons that reach us or that reach our eye impacts the intensity or how bright that specific light source seems to be. So the sun, for example, is giving off lots and lots and lots of photons and electromagnetic radiation. Of course, it's all throughout the spectrum. And incidentally, for those of you that don't know, I did my undergrad studies in biology, and I took as a side class, there was one class where we were talking about this a little bit more, and what was really interesting to me was that the peak of the sun's output in terms of radiation, so if you were to take a look at a graph of how much of each of these frequencies the sun, our sun, is outputting, you'll actually notice that the peak is in the visible spectrum. And this is actually very interesting from an evolutionary standpoint, because we have evolved then to be more sensitive to the most efficient output from the sun, which I think is actually a pretty interesting side story. But anyway, if you're ever wondering why we see that specific part of the spectrum, that is likely why we do it. But anyway, moving back a few steps, we can only see this small part of the spectrum, but the frequency, the wavelength, defines the color of that specific light source. So the sun, it has white light because it's a mixture of all of these colors, but if you were to take a look at just like a red LED, for example, the one that you might find on the back of a camera or on your cell phone, it's really only emitting light in a specific spectrum up here. Fluorescent lights, for example, give off a certain set of spectrum, and it's very heavily weighed towards the green side, although there's some spikes elsewhere. And if you were to take a look at some of these sources of light, it's actually very interesting to see how they output these wavelengths. What is really important for us in our discussion today about light as it applies to photography is photons. And that because it also acts not only as a wave but also as a particle, the number of photons that reach us matters. So the more photons that we see, the brighter something appears to be. And in fact, we can double or have the number of photons, and that will literally double or have the brightness of a particular scene. And so while that may not appear to us to be twice as bright or half as bright, because our eyes actually play some tricks on us that I'll talk about in just a little bit, we actually, when we're using cameras, this actually impacts us in a very, very real way. So the eye. So I did mention that I did study some biology, so I have to go over some of it here. But this is really just to be, because we're going to make a comparison from our eye to cameras. And as you will see shortly, there is not actually, there's obvious differences, but there's actually some very striking similarities between how we see and how a camera takes a photograph. So light comes in through the iris, and it gets focused by the lens that's here. Just as our camera would focus light into the camera's sensor through the lens, we also have a lens in our eye that focuses light onto the back of the eye. And the really important bit, and what provides us with a lot of our perception of light, or rather the perception of detail, is this small center called the macula. And within the macula, we have the fovea, and there's a whole bunch of cells in there that provide us with a lot of the detailed view that we can actually see. And so you'll notice that one of the things that's coming out of the eye is this the optic nerve that's protruding out of the rear, and because of the placement, because the optic nerve connects to the, it's not quite the rear of the eye, but it's slightly off center depending on which eye, it's either on the left or the right, there are actually no rods or cones. There are no cells that are capable of capturing light there. So you literally have a blind spot where the optic nerve meets the back of your eye. And in fact, there's you've probably seen a variety of optical illusions or optical tests where you can see two dots on a screen, for example, and they say, okay, move your face to a certain distance from the screen, looking only at one dot, and then all of a sudden the other dot disappears. That's because that dot is all of a sudden right underneath, or the dot is being displayed right here, right over the optic nerve. And so your brain, or your eye rather, cannot see it. But what your brain is doing is playing a trick on you, and it's filling in the surrounding colors and the surrounding detail into that portion. So what is transparent to us, what we don't notice, we don't see a black hole sort of where that blind spot is. Our brain still perceives something that's there, some bit of data, but this can actually impact the way that we view a scene. And in fact, it's a very real, it's a very, very real problem, especially when we need to, when we are doing something that, you know, is very heavily dependent on vision. So driving, for example, if something happens to be coming at you in that very small portion, you may not ever see it. And it's actually a very plausible description. And in fact, I've noticed at least in my car when I'm driving, that if I'm looking right down the center of the road, sometimes the line on the right side is right under that spot, and I can't actually see the very far right part of the road because it's where the optic nerve is meeting my eye, and it's actually sort of disorienting when I notice it because I'm like, oh, where's the edge of the road? But it's still, don't worry, it's still there. You can just move your eye, just look the other way, and you will certainly see it there. So just a slightly more detailed view. So what we have here, this is also another view of the eye. This is more top down. So we have the light that comes in through all the way up there through the pupil and the lens, and then comes down through and hits the fovea. But also, I mean, the light does scatter, and it does go to various regions within the eye here where you have a variety of optical cells. But the fovea is really important to us for our sight, and it's very small portion, as you can see, but this is where the majority of the cells that contain our detail viewing, so where we perceive detail, are actually present. So there are, within the middle of the fovea, there's even a smaller section that's called the foveola. And so this is getting to a bit of detail that's a bit extreme. But in there's no rod cells. We only have cone cells. So if you're familiar, there are two types of cells in our eye, rod cell and a cone cell. And the cone cell is what gives us the ability to have detailed vision. And it's only a very, very small percentage of our sight that we actually have the greatest amount of visual acuity. It's only something like 2% or something ridiculous like that, where we actually can view the most amount of details as possible. So this doesn't mean that the rod cells are actually useless. It's actually quite the opposite. The rod cells are what gives us a lot of our motion capabilities. They're what helps us see at night, but we have the greatest percentage of rod cells along the periphery. So outside of the fovea, do we have a lot of the rod cells that we see? And in fact, I have here a chart that shows us the difference between some of the rods and cones and how this actually impacts us and our vision. So rods, for example, are primarily responsible for our night vision, whereas cones are responsible for our day vision. If you've ever been to a planetarium, and they always tell you that when you're stargazing, one of the things that you want to do when you want to look at something at night is to not look directly at it, but look away from it, and just out of the periphery of your vision, look at something, you'll be able to see it a lot better. It is for this reason. It is that we have no rods in the very center of our vision, which is responsible for night vision, so we actually have no visual acuity at the darkest parts of night in the center of our eye. So you can't look directly at something. If you want to see something with more visual acuity at night, you actually need to look slightly away from it and just pay attention to the periphery of your vision. So this means that rods then are more sensitive to light, whereas cones are less sensitive to light. So the rods then are also, like I said, they're not in the fovea, whereas the cones are concentrated in the fovea, and this is what gives us a lot of the results in a lot of the things that I was just talking about. However, within the retina, within the back, the part of your eye that's responsible for sight, we do have many more rods than we do cones. So this is actually pretty important to us. But what's even more important to us, arguably, as photographers, is that rods are only, they cannot see color. They really are sort of black and white, so to speak. Whereas cones, we are able to see color through cones. And what this means is that we actually have three different types of cone cells in our eye. And each one can detect various types of wavelengths that we saw earlier, the combination of which our brain is able to figure out what the color of some particular aspect of the scene is. But another thing about rods and cones that I mentioned before is that rods, they're better at detecting motion, so they're a bit faster, so to speak, whereas cones are better at detecting detail. So this is why in the periphery this is why our peripheral vision is very, very good, not only at night, but also with objects that are coming towards us or away from us. We're able to detect motion a lot better in our periphery than right in the middle of our vision. So you can imagine some of the things by knowing just these relatively simple facts about rod cells and cone cells. You can imagine some of the things that might happen if we, say, lose the ability to use our rods. So what might happen in that case? Yeah, can't see at night. We can't see motion as well. And as you know, if we lost some cones, we would not only lose the ability to detect detail, but it would be difficult for us to view things during the daylight, so we'd have to wear some really thick sunglasses to block out a lot of light. But it's even possible, as I mentioned before, that we have that since we have three different types of cone cells, that losing one type of these cone cells can mean that we have some sort of deficiency in viewing a particular range of color. And in fact, this is where color blindness comes from, is that we lose one of these types of cone cells, and we are therefore unable to view that particular wavelength in it. And so and there's lots of different types of color blindness, and it all depends on which combination of cone cells you have actually lost, whether it is the S, the M, or the L. And so you'll notice that these are labeled such, S, M, and L. But our eye is made up primarily, where there are cone cells, is made up primarily of the M type and the L type. So we as humans in the average person that is perceiving color will have 98% of their cones will be M and L types, and only 2% will be S types. And so what this means to us is that we actually can discern green and red a lot better than we can discern blue colors. And so, we could turn this again into some sort of an evolutionary argument where, sure, you know, a lot of the Earth is green, and so we need to be able to detect various types of green, so on and so forth. I'm not really sure if that's exactly what's going on here, but it is what it is. And so this is very important to us that we cannot detect, just like if you're familiar with how well we can detect audio. We can't, so low frequencies, for example, of what we can hear, it doesn't sound as loud as higher frequencies, but not the super highest frequencies, if that makes sense. So we have this sort of changing perception of sound. So to really hear low frequencies really loud, we have to really turn it up high. It's the same sort of thing with color, where blue color or short wavelengths are more difficult for us to perceive. In fact, don't appear as bright as green and red. Yes?
Would that have something to do with color blindness?
Does this have something to do with color blindness? What do you mean?
Well, would there be something off in the rods and cones in somebody's eyes why they can't see, certain colors?
Yes. Well, color blindness arises from the fact that one or more of these cone cells are missing.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So for example, if someone loses their S cones, for example, and I forget which, type of color blindness is the most prevalent, but then they will lose the ability to perceive of blue color blindness. However, I expect that because we have such a high percentage of M and L type, that it's probably red-green color blindness is probably one of the more not popular, but one of the more prevalent ways of boy, open mouth, insert foot. One of the more common ways to lose the ability to view color, just because we have so much greater percentage of those in the average person. But anyway, the M and the L type, so these two, and I guess this is another reason why, these two types of cones are on the X chromosome. And so because males only have one X chromosome and a Y chromosome, it's very easy for there to be a mutation or deletion in one of those genes, then therefore one of these two cells is just not present. That's why it's much more prevalent in men than in women. But anyway, this is important to us, but also it's really useful to know that green and red are much more important to our vision than blue, and this will come in handy in a few lectures when we're talking about digital cameras. Even digital cameras use this fact to try to help them when they are taking a photo. And how we detect brightness is greatly perceived by how many of these cone cells we have. So because we have so many of these M-type cells, we can actually perceive, we use a lot of the green color information to help us detect brightness in a particular scene. Okay, so that's all really well and interesting, but this is really where it comes down to how it is relevant to us. So this stuff, the eye is an analogy for a camera and vice versa. Really what we are doing in cameras is very similar to what our eye is doing when we are viewing a scene. We are focusing, we are inputting light from a scene, we are focusing it using some lens, and we are capturing it using some means of capturing the light. So just like our lens focuses the light, our camera lens will focus the light, and just like our fovea will capture the detail in a particular scene, so will our sensor. Though a sensor is much more uniform than the fovea of our eye, or than the back of our eye rather, and will detect the amount of, it would look really weird if really only the middle part of an image had all the detail and all the outside didn't. But anyway, when I was talking about photons and how increasing or decreasing the number of photons will actually increase or decrease the amount of light in the scene, this directly impacts us as photographers. And we have this concept of EV, or exposure value, where we measure how bright something is in relative terms by using a term called stop. So when we are talking about one stop brighter or one stop darker, we are talking about literally having or doubling the amount of light and therefore the number of photons that are in the scene. So if we double the number of photons in a particular scene, we can make it twice as bright for the camera. So it doesn't look to be twice as bright to us because the way that we perceive brightness is not linear. It's not a one-to-one relationship. It's actually very, very skewed in this almost logarithmic looking graph. But a camera is very literal when it is taking and recording photons from a scene. So if we have a well-exposed scene, and it looks a little bit dark here because of the projector, but this is from the photo, the pinhole photo from the first lecture, as you remember, which you can view on the Flickr group site if you are so interested in. We can also increase the exposure by one or two stops, which therefore means that we had twice as many photons, or twice and twice, so four times as many photons as the original scene. And so a camera sensor is very sensitive to the number of photons that it can read. There's a very hard limit on the fewest number of photons that it can read and the most number of photons that it can read. Once you've gone outside of that range, then you were either completely underexposed, that there's no data when there's a lack of photons, or there's not enough photons for it to capture detail, or you've gone the other direction and you're overexposed. And so as we can see in this photo is looking a little bit overexposed, because whereas before we could see some detail, for example, there's a little bit of writing here on this page. It is now completely obliterated over here. And so there's details additionally in the background that have now been obliterated. They look completely white. They've been blown out, so to speak, or they've been overexposed because we weren't carefully measuring the photons that are entering into the camera. And luckily, the camera will do a lot of this calculating for us. We don't actually have to know, okay, my camera can read 3 photons up to about 25,000. So that means that I have to convert that number to some shutter speed or something like that. No, luckily, the camera will do a lot of that for us. But overexposing or underexposing a photo is a bad thing. It's probably one of the worst things you can do for your photograph, because you will lose that data and you will never be able to get it back. So in this case, this isn't 3 different photos. This is actually 1 photo where it's been increased in exposure using software just for demonstration purposes. But I use the same one because it's easy then to spot the differences from one photo to the next. But there's a variety of ways that we can limit or enhance, well, we can't really enhance the number of photons, but we can either limit or not limit the number of photons that enter into our camera. And this is the topic of not only the rest of today's lecture, but also the next lecture as well, and that is dealing with exposure, and in today's lecture, shutter speed. So shutter speed is, remember, the speed through which the shutter is open, exposes the sensor, and then it closes. And if you remember the video from last time, it was pretty quick. It was a very slow motion video of a mirror going up and then a shutter opening and then closing. And we actually can define how much time that shutter is open and how much time that light is able to hit the sensor. And remember that whenever we double or halve the light, we are making it twice as bright or half as bright, respectively. So therefore, we can affect the exposure by doubling or halving the shutter speed. Because if we double the amount of time that the shutter is open, then we are doubling the number of photons that are able to hit it, and therefore we are making it one stop brighter. So when you are adjusting exposure on your camera, one of the options you have is shutter speed. And whenever you halve or double the shutter speed, you are increasing by one stop or decreasing by one stop, respectively. And there are a variety of shutters that are available. So we did see a horizontal plane shutters where it was 2 shutters that moved in sort of synchronous motion down the sensor from the videos from last time. But there are others available as well, particularly in the film days. We had some that went across, it was oriented vertically. And even in some of the larger format cameras, we have what are called leaf shutters, where it's sort of closed and then it opens, like sort of like an aperture, which we'll talk about next time. But it's like a closed aperture, and then all of a sudden it opens up, allowing more light to be captured in. And so, when we're talking about exposure in photographs, it's usually a very interesting thing to talk about how long an image was exposed, because this tells us quite a bit about the image. So in this case, for example, this was the pinhole photo, and this had an exposure time of 602 seconds. So just over 10 minutes was the shutter open and collecting photons. So that's actually quite a long time for a camera to be collecting photons, but we'll talk about this later, but it's because we were really restricting the amount of light elsewhere. So this is made possible. So usually when you're adjusting the shutter speed on your camera, you're given a variety of options. So you might have something as fast as maybe 1/8,000th of a second or 1/4,000th of a second, which is really fast, really, really fast. But usually you can only go as slow as about 30 seconds. And when I'm talking about fast and slow, 1/8,000th of a second, that's how long that shutter is open. That's not open for a very long time at all. But being open for 30 seconds, that's a long time for you to have to stand there and hold the camera to be still. So if 30 seconds isn't slow enough for you, which it obviously wasn't in the case of this pinhole camera or in this pinhole photo, you can use what some cameras have, which is called a bulb mode. And the bulb mode allows you to take a photo for as long as you are holding down the shutter. And you'll remember that I wasn't holding down the shutter, but there are some remotes that allow you to actually lock the shutter open until you're ready to close it. And that's exactly what I did. I had a remote connected to it, and I locked the shutter open so it was in bulb mode, collecting all of those photons through the pinhole. And then when the timer was up, we just turned off the shutter, and then it closed and did the final calculations when saving the photo. So you'll notice that there's a particular effect that we can see with this photo. And that is that everything is blurry, 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 and fuzzy, fuzzy, fuzzy. And that is because of motion blur. So one of the effects of shutter speed on a photo is motion blur, where the longer that it is open and collecting photons, the fuzzier things will tend to be, especially things that are in motion. Because you can imagine if we have a, it's always hard to come up with an analogy for this, but if light is coming from one particular spot and you open the shutter and then you move that light, now that light has actually been moved across the sensor, and so it will actually appear to be a streak on the sensor rather than just one solid block of light. And so this is very apparent to us when we are adjusting shutter speed on our cameras. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why this photo is so blurry, because at 10 minutes, you folks were moving around a lot, and so the details in your faces, for example, were actually changed or were actually blurred out quite a bit just by your simple motions. And this is one reason why the tripod is so important, is that if you have a shutter speed that is at all not very quick, then you are going to need some way of steadying or stabilizing the camera so that it doesn't move. And remember that these pixels are very, very, very small in a camera, and they're smaller than a human hair. So if you move your camera, even just a human hair's amount in the time that shutter speed or that the shutter is open, you could get motion blur within the image, even if it is very slight. But this is sometimes an effect that we want. So sometimes you want to be able to have the shutter open for a long period of time and get motion and movement within it. So fireworks, for example, is one thing that you really want to see, the motion of the fireworks. If you take fireworks photos with a typical camera, sometimes it will try to make the shutter speed too fast so that you only see a very small part of the firework. You don't see its motion. And usually what you want in fireworks are motion so that you can actually see the fireworks moving throughout the frame. So you want to have a couple of seconds maybe of time where the shutter is open so that you can capture that sort of effect. And if you notice, and from now on I'll be posting exposure values for all of these photos in the lower left hand corner so that you can see if you're interested. This photo had an exposure value of 10 seconds. And so luckily these other things are relatively sharp because they didn't move very much in that 10 seconds. So relatively they have stayed still while the fireworks instead have moved. And another thing about fireworks before I forget, it's really tough to get good fireworks photos unless you have a lot of wind and a really, really stable tripod. Because when you take a long exposure, and a long exposure meaning a shutter speed of several seconds or more, when you take a long exposure of fireworks, you usually have smoke to deal with as well, and that can really ruin a photograph. And usually when you have relatively high winds that it can push the smoke out of the way quickly, that's usually when you will get the best fireworks. But also wind pushing will also push your camera, so that's a bad thing as well. So you need a good sturdy tripod, one that you can weigh down maybe by adding some additional weight on the middle, for example, to give it some additional stability, and then make sure that it doesn't sway as much in the wind. Because remember, I told you that if you move it even so much as the width of one human hair, you will get potentially motion blur within your images. But it's more than just fireworks that you might want to use long exposures. You might also want to do it for moving water as well. So still water is kind of cool, but one of the best effects is when you can get this really sort of milky white water that can result from a very long exposure. Was there a question?
Yeah, Julian,
is there any fear of damaging the sensor if you leave the shutter open for too long? No, not that I know of. The worst thing that can really happen, there's a couple things that happen. When it's open and reading light, it's generating heat. So in very hot environments, this can be a problem because heat will cause artifacts on the screen. But the other problem is that long exposure shots will sometimes, you'll also sometimes get what are called hot pixels. So it's one or two pixels on the image that are completely red or completely blue, and it looks very, very much out of place. But usually that's what those long exposure correction or long exposure reduction or something like that. Most cameras have a feature that also takes a similarly long photo with the shutter closed so that it can read the same hot pixels in a completely black frame, and it just subtracts out those hot pixels from the original photo. So for very long exposures, that's usually the only thing you have to contend with. And particularly when you're taking photos of astrophotography, for example, where you may be dealing with photos that are that have shutter speeds of hours or you know, well, several hours is a pretty long time, but then that will become an issue there. But I don't think you have to worry about or battery drainage as well. That's another problem. But you don't really have to worry about it damaging the sensor necessarily. So getting some motion in the frame can actually be very visually interesting. So, for example, you can get a very milky white stream of water, for example. And so in this case, I wish that I had been able to capture a longer shutter speed. But as you can imagine, this shutter speed was only 2 seconds. But as you can imagine, when you're dealing with a very, very bright situation where there's lots of light coming down, it's difficult to try to keep the shutter open for longer because you run into that problem I described before where you simply cannot put too much light into the sensor. Otherwise, it will just completely overexpose. It will be completely completely overexposed. But on the other hand, sometimes you want to completely stop motion as well. And you can use a very fast shutter speed for this. And usually, you want to do this for things such as sports. So when you really want to freeze the action and see, how crazy the people contort their faces or how much the ball has become oblonged by their kicking it, for example, usually want to get as fast of a shutter speed as you possibly can. So in this case, this was a shutter speed of 1,250th of a second. So that's 1/1,250, which is a pretty quick time when taking a photo. And so for sports, this is the general case. You're going to want to stop action as much as possible for sports. That means increasing the shutter speed, and when I say increasing, I mean making it faster, as much as possible. And even for this, it might actually be worthwhile to have a tripod, because when you're following people that are moving very, very quickly, you don't want to introduce additional movement into the camera, even at 1,250th of a second. The camera was still moving a little bit because I was, panning to follow these players as this photo was taken. And so having a tripod or even a monopod for sports photos is sometimes advantageous there as well. Yes? This wasn't noontime. It does help. Yes, so it does help because there's more than just shutter speed that affects exposure, and we'll talk about the rest the next time. But the more light you have, the more opportunity you have to make a shutter speed faster. So in this case, it could be this quick because it was outside. It was midday, even though I think it was overcast. And actually, being overcast and midday is one of the best times to take sports photos, because one of the things you notice is that there are no harsh shadows. There's no harsh light on the players. It's very diffuse light. It's very soft light, which really helps the photograph, any photograph, really. So having lighting conditions like that was nearly ideal for a photo such as this. However, there are some occasions, even in sports, where you don't want to freeze all of the action. Sometimes you want to do a mixture of both freezing the action of the important bits and giving the perception of motion elsewhere. And you can do this with sort of a moderate length shutter speed and a very steady hand. So if in this case, this was a car that was moving by very, very quickly, and at only 1/320th of a second, as it moved by, when you open the shutter and you're taking the photo, as long as you keep following the object that's moving, then the center part will remain sharp while the other part the other portions of the image that you were not following will appear blurry because there is some movement while that shutter is open. So mixing these two is actually a really neat but also kind of difficult thing to do because not only are you moving it left and right, but you're almost guaranteed to be kind of moving it up and down a little bit or shaking it in some way. And so if you're seeing some motion horizontally, there's almost probably some motion vertically as well. And there are some exceptions to this that we will, of course, talk about at a later thing. You'll notice that it's one of the big things is that we build up a lot of this material and I tease you with a lot of it. But eventually, by the end, you will feel relief in that you will know all of this material. And so there is a way to help combat this additional vibration vertically here. And I'll give you a hint. It's image stabilization. But you can still get this sort of lateral motion that exists. And so pretty much anything where you selectively are able to keep portions of the frame absolutely sharp in focus. And that means not moving the camera at all relative to those portions in the frame, you can get some really neat effects. So here, for example, by strapping down your tripod very, very tightly into your passenger seat, can you take a photo where pretty much all of the dashboard of your car is still? It looks sharp and it's still, but everything else outside is moving. And so this was a 2.5 second exposure. So it was open for that long, and luckily it was tied down sharp. The tripod was tied down enough that the rest was able to be in sharp focus. And so having this sort of context for having when you have motion blur and something else that's also sharp in the image can make for a very visually appealing image. And so this is, though, not only somewhat difficult to do, but you also don't want to move the tripod at all, because if you get any motion blur at all, so if I had hit the tripod, for example, or been unlucky and hit a pothole or something, then all of these portions would then appear blurry because it would have just bounced ever so slightly, just enough to do it. And so there's a very fine line between having acceptable motion blur and having unacceptable motion blur, at least from my perspective. And I think having some bits within the image to ground you in terms of the context helps a lot. So if the same image had been completely blurry, I don't think it would be as interesting or as successful, because then it's just another blurry photo among a sea of blurry photos. So in general, motion blur is bad because you are usually getting rid of details that you want to keep. So in this case, it would have been nice to have all the details throughout this image, and the motion blur wasn't a bad thing. But it can be a good thing depending on the particular effect that you want to have, whether it be fireworks, water, even sports, or even just some sort of artsy pic, doesn't really matter. But really, when you stop the motion, that is how you can really get some good sports photos, as I said. So although I've shown you a lot of photos where motion blur has been mixed into it, a lot of times you actually want to eliminate motion blur as much as possible. And so that means having a lot of light and having a very fast shutter speed. And so this was one that's at 1/1000th of a second, and it was fast enough to actually capture droplets of water that are falling off of the raft. And so it's makes for a visually appealing, and though I could argue that, sure, having a little bit of motion blur as that car had in it might also be visually appealing. There's, you need to use your judgment and try different things and learn your own particular style. And so, but to make some of these shutter speed values a little bit more concrete, in general, when you are taking a look at shutter speed, so let's say your camera reports to you that it wants to take a photo at a shutter speed of 1/60th of a second, for example. Now that is what it is. That's a pretty fast time. It's not fast enough to stop all motion, obviously, but it's a pretty good time. Generally, when you are looking through your camera's lens and you're about to take a photo, you should try to think about that shutter speed and the focal length of your lens. And so we'll talk about focal length, of course, as always, in a later lecture. But if you have a focal length of about 60 millimeters, and you can look on your lens to see what the focal length range is, excuse me, And when I'm talking about focal length here, I'm talking about on SLR cameras. Digital cameras or smaller compact cameras do have focal length ranges, but they're much, much smaller, so it's harder to do the same calculation. But on SLR cameras, the general rule is 1 over the focal length is the slowest shutter speed that you can take a reasonably sharp photograph. So at 1/60th of a second, I can use a 60 millimeter lens, for example, and get a pretty fast or get a pretty good, pretty sharp photo. But if I were using a 70 millimeter lens or a 200 millimeter lens, using 1/60th of a second isn't going to probably is probably not going to be fast enough. And the reason for that is that when we're looking through through these lenses, longer focal lengths are more zoomed in. So the more zoomed in you are, the harder it is to keep the camera still. So that's something to keep in mind. But when we're talking about 1/60th of a second, let's say that I have maybe a 100 millimeter lens on my camera, how many stops should I adjust that to get a reasonably sharp photo? So from 1/60th of a second, I could double it or halve it, each of which is a stop. If I double it, what will the shutter speed be? Right, well, doubling technically is 1/30th. So doubling it is because when you were doubling the shutter speed, you're making it slower. And remember that the smaller number on the bottom of the fraction will mean a slower number. So 1/30th is a slower time. So what I actually need to do is make it one stop faster. So do about 1/120th of a second. And this is possible to do. There's more than just shutter speed when we're talking about exposure values. So you can adjust more than just the shutter speed when you need to try to keep the light within the permissible range of the sensor, but you need to get some particular exposure value, so whether it be shutter speed, aperture, or ISO, to achieve the end result that you want. And so how we will adjust all of these things, we will talk about next week. So thank you all for coming, and we will see you next week when we continue talking about exposure values.